I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we're talking with people who are using the internet to help you explore your city. Want to find out what's happening in your neighborhood? Adrian Holovaty knows. He's the founder of everyblock.com, a website that gives you hyper-local news tailored to your street address. We'll give the site a test run and see what's happening on our block. We'll also speak with Jennifer Coleman. Jennifer's produced a series of audio tours called City Prowl that illuminate the special stories and special places of her home city of Cleveland. We'll hear a sample from one of her tours and talk to her about the future of her site. And we'll have regular contributors Nate Berg and Walker Smith after the break today on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Adrian Holovaty is one of the pioneers of journalism on the web. After a career as a web developer and journalist, he created everyblock.com. The site gathers civic information, news updates, and photos from across the web that relate to your neighborhood right down to your home address. Adrian joined us in our offices to talk about the site. Adrian, what was your impulse for Everyblock?
Well, for a number of years, I've operated a site called ChicagoCrime.org here in Chicago that let residents search for crime in their neighborhoods. And I always thought it would be cool to add more information to that so that you can type in an address and see not just crime, but everything that's happened recently around there. So public records, news reports, fun, wacky things from across the internet, etc.
So what was the impulse for the crime site?
Well, back in 2005, Google had just released its Google Maps mapping application, and due to some of the technology decisions that they made, it was possible for people to reverse engineer that and add maps to their own sites. And I also, at the same time, had found the Chicago Police Department's crime site, and I thought, wow, this is a lot of really interesting data that is just genuinely useful to Chicago residents, and it would be cool if there were some alternate ways of browsing it. So I took my little experimentation with Google Maps and put it together with this crime data and made the site called ChicagoCrime.org back in 2005.
And how did you come to this work?
Well, my background is in journalism and computer science. I've carved out this really wacky niche of making web applications that are interactive, you know, databases of information, but in a journalism context. So data that tells stories.
Describe Everyblock. Describe the site and how it works.
The basic concept is that you enter your address or your neighborhood or your zip code, and you get a personalized page for your immediate location. And that page includes any and every piece of information that we can find that's happened near you. So three general categories. One is we catalog news articles throughout the city. So anything that may have been written about by your daily newspapers, your community weeklies, your local blogs, we catalog all that and tell you which articles you may be interested in based on your location. The second thing is a wide variety of public records. So every crime near you, every restaurant inspection, so you can see whether your pizza place is past inspection.
You don't want to know that.
And building permits, business licenses. You can see which businesses have applied for licenses in your neighborhood, liquor licenses, all sorts of this civic data. And then the third big bucket is wacky stuff from across the internet. So photos that have been posted to photo sharing websites that have been geotagged, in other words, marked as having been taken in your neighborhood from sites like Flickr, and restaurant reviews on sites like Yelp.com. And the thinking here is that it's news to you that someone has written about something in your neighborhood or has taken a photo about something in your neighborhood. So we just put it all into the mix.
What's the most popular feature on the site?
Well, it's most definitely our crime statistics, but that number is skewed because since we launched Everyblock, I've redirected ChicagoCrime.org to the site, and that means that all the people we're going to Chicago Crime now go to every block, and that, and they don't necessarily know that there's all the other stuff on every block, so it skews the numbers.
Do you think it will continue that way?
Probably, because it tends to be the, I want to say sexiest, but it's not really sexy. It's the most...
Urgent?
Urgent and sort of guttural, you know, primal thing, like, will I live to see tomorrow? You know, like, am I going to get mugged on my way to the train station?
Why don't you include a feature that allows users to find their alderman or their state representative or their congressman?
That's a really good question. Our focus for the moment has been on news. So everything that you see on our site is date and time sensitive. When you go to your address page, for example, you'll see a very basic timeline of what's happened recently. Our thinking is, at the moment at least, that if you are a returning visitor to our site, you're checking out all the new news in your neighborhood, you already know where you go vote, you already know where your neighborhood grocery store is or where you go catch the train. But we've had so much demand for that that we might add it at some point.
I think you should add it. Let me add my voice to that. In fact, there's no activist aspect of the site, and you've explained why. There's no way to figure out how to volunteer or get politically engaged. Is one of the reasons that there's no standard source of information for it? There's nothing you can draw from, and since you're not generating original content, there's not a source for you?
Sure. One thing that we do want to add is upcoming events in your neighborhood, and that would certainly include activism stuff. It's just a matter of us adding that capability. So right now, everything, again, is based on what happened today and before, as opposed to what's happening later today and into the future. So it's only a matter of time before we add that stuff.
And would you imagine providing a method for users of the site to enter that data themselves or enter that information themselves, or would you try to draw on some other resource?
It's feasible. Our strategy so far has been that we don't want to reinvent a photo sharing site. We don't want to reinvent a restaurant review site. So we say that if you desperately want one of your photographs to show up on every block, here's how you go to Flickr, this third-party site. And if you submit it in such and such a way, it'll show up on our site. So we don't want to reinvent those things. It's kind of, you know, the friendly web way of doing things, how linking out to things rather than being one centralized location. Mm-hmm. So with regard to events, there's already a bunch of event sites that we might be able to tap into. But again, one thing we do add to the table is this neighborhood civic focus that I'm not really familiar with any event site that collects events of that nature.
Because it occurred to me, there are, looking at the site and typing in my own zip code, as I've done several times, there are people down the hall from me I don't know.
Sure.
And it just struck me that this is telling me so much about my neighborhood, but nothing about my neighbors.
Right. So this is another thing that a lot of people have requested. And I would like to add that sort of functionality, and that would be basically like a meetup.com, but for your immediate area. I think that's a really powerful concept. And I guess all I'd have to say is stay tuned.
Okay. What would you most like to add to the site?
Ooh. There are all sorts of pieces of information that we have campaigned for from governments, but we haven't yet had access to, such as 311 information here for the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So that's like every...
That'd be great.
Oh, yeah. Every pothole reported, every, you know, rat sighting, every sighting of vandalism, you know, all that stuff.
I think that would be phenomenal. I had a rat sighting the other night.
Oh, yes. I've had my share.
So that would be interesting. 311 data would be very interesting to see.
311 would be good. And I will say that we do have it already for Washington, D.C.
You do?
One interesting thing about working on this project is that every city is different.
In terms of their willingness to share?
Their willingness to share, the availability of data in the first place. Even the nature of the information. Like in some cities, we might have movie filmings, but in others, like Charlotte, North Carolina, there a lot of filmings don't happen there. Like earthquakes data is something that we've looked into for Los Angeles and San Francisco, two of our cities. We ended up tossing that because an earthquake isn't really micro-local. It sort of either hits the city or doesn't, at least according to the data that we looked at. It's really interesting from a civic perspective, looking at the various cities and seeing what they offer and how much of it they offer, how much of it they're hiding or don't have digitized. And we've sort of become domain experts at that very small area of figuring out what this particular municipality offers to the public and what it doesn't.
Do you have pending zoning applications on
the
site?
We do in San Francisco, and I believe in Charlotte. We don't in our other cities. I may be missing one that we do have, but
well,
we do.
Tell me, run down the cities that are part of every block.
So we launched with Chicago, New York City, every borough there, and San Francisco, and then since then we've added Philadelphia, Charlotte, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Boston, and Los Angeles.
What level of conversation do you have in each city? Where do you enter the discussion with a city to try to get the data?
So it really depends on the department. We do a substantial amount of research into sort of how the city works, the political implications of everything. And for one department, we might approach it by writing a letter to the main honcho. For another city, we might try to just call, you know, the main line. For another city, we might know someone who knows someone, and that helps us. It really is completely
city by city,
city by city, department by department even.
Okay, so who's the main honcho? Is that the mayor? Is that the IT guy? Who's the main honcho?
That, again, is different sort of politically depending on the nature of the city. In the department, it would be sort of like the superintendent or the director of the department. In a city like Chicago, it would be obviously Mayor Daley. Yeah, it really, again, does depend on the city and the department.
Have you had the conversations in Chicago around 311?
We have, and we were told that the city's working on a data sharing policy, which is very intriguing. It's been a couple months, so we're still hoping they're working on it. And supposedly, once they're done, they'll have a firm city policy on we're trying to share data with the public and with these independent news organizations like Every Block, and here's our policy for what we share and what we don't share.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Adrian Hulavati about his website, everyblock.com. Every Block scours the web for news, blog entries, pictures, crime reports that focus on your neighborhood.
The Knight Foundation has helped you fund expansion of the site.
Yes. It is our only funding.
Your only funding. What is it they see in Every Block? Why are they helping you enter new markets and funding you and making it possible for you to devote full time to this?
Well, this site is the result of a journalism contest called the Knight News Challenge. And the idea of the contest was to invite wacky ideas that could possibly expand and innovate in the world of journalism. So my background is in journalism, always, you know, working for newspaper websites. And the incentive that Knight Foundation has in funding us is that they're getting two things out of it. One, we're a test bed for the news industry. So if we succeed, if we fail, whatever happens, anyone in the news industry will be able to see, oh, hey, that was actually a pretty good idea, or hey, that was a bad idea to provide news for people at such a granular level. And then the second thing that they get is that it's a tangible outcome, and that's our open source code. So at the end of our grant period, which is in the middle of next year, 2009, we are going to open source the code that powers the site. So in other words, what that makes possible is any citizen, anyone, whether it's a news organization or just a citizen or even the government itself, will be able to take our code and create an Every Block-ish site for their own city.
Where does that leave you?
That is a really great question. we have yet to figure out how we're going to feed our families once the grant runs out. We could do the classic open source business model, which is which has been done by companies like Red Hat, where the code is free, but you pay for support and services and that sort of thing. Like, essentially, it would be a consultancy. The other option is that we can start adding some local advertising, specifically that micro level. I've just heard a lot about businesses not really having an outlet for advertising at such a local level. It's either you advertise with the newspaper in town and you reach thousands of people that you really don't care to reach, and you pay for that privilege even though you might not want to. Or you go with something like Google, which is not really locally based, it's more keyword based. So we could play around with that too.
You know, I was thinking about the coupons that are delivered, right, for restaurants and local services, salons and so forth, to condos. And the chances of those coupons actually getting into my kitchen are not very good, because, I mean, they're put in strange places, they're put on the backside of the postal area, which I don't go to, or whatever. And I was thinking that would make so much sense for every block.
Yeah, if you open those coupons at all. Like, I tend to toss that stuff out just with the rest of the mail spam. Yeah, that would be a fantastic addition to our site, and I look forward to experimenting with it.
Let me ask you something. Does it matter that people know more about their neighborhood if they don't understand the larger context of the city in which their neighborhood resides? In other words, do you think people can be too parochial?
That's something that we always try to avoid doing. But I think our main argument is that you have a more fundamental, not only an understanding, but a more fundamental level of caring in sort of city processes if it directly affects your life. So an example is sign permits in New York City. It's really obscure topic, right? Like signs. Like, so in order for a business to have a sign of a certain size, you need to apply for a sign permit. And there's a, you know, multi-step process with that. And, you know, what percentage of New York City residents actually know or care about that process? Extremely low, probably less than 0.5%. But because on the Every Block New York City version, we have sign permits, we've done the work of not only showing you what's happening in your neighborhood in the world of sign permits, but we also say how it fits into the bigger picture. So we employ a managing editor whose job it is to explain all of this information. And if it's something that has to do with a process, like a liquor license or a sign permit or a building permit, we try to very clearly explain the entire process. And for many of these data types, for every step in the process, you'll see a notification on your Every Block page. So for liquor licenses, for example, you might see, oh, this restaurant applied for a liquor license. And then maybe a month or two later, you'll see, oh, the license was approved. And then at the end of this spectrum, we have, oh, this license was discontinued for whatever reason. So because we have those little micro snippets, we think that gets people more interested in the bigger process.
Have you thought about doing metrics like crime is up, crime is down, or this kind of crime is up, you know, or home prices, housing prices in your zip code are up or down?
Right now, we've been doing more of that lately. For every type of information we have just a very basic how many things were there per day. So if it's crime, there's like, you know, 800 crimes were reported today, 796 were yesterday. That isn't very helpful, of course. So we are looking into more intelligent aggregation. Not only, so there's two aspects to this. One is doing the aggregation ourselves and picking out the interesting trends. And the second is giving the users the tools to
do it themselves,
Which is much more interesting.
It's exciting what you're doing. You invite users on the site to send in their suggestions. What have they told you?
Ooh, so I assume you're referring to the feedback at the bottom of every single page. So I would wholeheartedly recommend this technique to anyone who's operating a website in the world. It's fantastic. And just to explain what I mean by this, at the bottom of every single page on every block, there's a little form where we say, you know, comments, love letters, critiques, please send them our way. And we get a dozen or so of these every day from all sorts of people. At the beginning, we were getting a lot of feedback that suggested people didn't really understand what our site did. They thought that we were the official government source, or they thought we were the news outlet that we were linking to. So we made some changes. In the next incarnation, it was kind of funny. We started getting a lot of reports like, put more cops on the streets and we'll clean up the vandalism. I was like, why are they asking this? Or why are they saying this? And it turns out that the way our question was worded, it was, how can we make every block better? And it was being answered by people who didn't necessarily realize that every block was the name of a website, not like literally every block. How can we make every block better? Put more cops on the streets, you know? So we've reworded that.
That's really, I love that. Well, Adrian, I appreciate what you're doing for every block, and thanks for being our guest on Smart
Sure,
City.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian Holovaty is the creator of Every Block. We'll have a link to the site on our site, smartcityradio.com, so you can see what's going on your block. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg at Plan Edison.
This November, Californians will face the $10 billion question, high-speed rail. The long-planned train system that would connect Northern and Southern California finally made its way onto the statewide ballot after receiving the signature of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in August. It's a project many transit advocates have been pushing for years, but some worry that the current downturn in the economy may affect the political feasibility of this long-term and admittedly expensive project. A recent opinion piece from the Sacramento Bee warns that the push for high-speed rail could face further budgetary hurdles, as the state is expected to see $10 billion fewer tax dollars next year. Pulling another $10 billion out to fund a bullet train will likely be a tough choice for a lot of voters. Meanwhile, voters in Honolulu are facing their own transit conundrum this election season. Public transportation has been a pebble in the shoe of officials of the Hawaiian capital for years, and this year they've been making major steps towards fixing the problem. As the Honolulu Star Bulletin reports, one possible solution has been a $4 billion light rail system, advocated heavily by incumbent Mayor Mufi Hanuman. But like his proposal, Mayor Hanuman is on this November's ballot. Opposing him is candidate Ann Kobayashi, who also has a transit plan. She has proposed a broad bus system plan that would include dedicated busways, tunnels, and bus rapid transit, all for roughly $2.5 billion, a significant price cut from the incumbent's rail plan. So as voters in Honolulu head to the election booth to vote for a mayor, they'll not only be choosing a person to lead their city, but also a transit plan, one that will likely have a greater long-term impact on the future of Honolulu than the candidate behind it. And finally, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has come under some heat from the National Academy of Sciences for failing to control pollution. According to the Associated Press, a recent Academy report called out the EPA for not doing enough to stem urban stormwater runoff. This runoff is kind of the sweat of the city. Gutter trash, fertilizers, and street oil accumulates on the vast paved surfaces of cities, and it's carried away with rainwater, which then runs off into sewer drains, and ultimately lakes, rivers, and oceans. This report says the EPA is failing to control this major pollution source. Currently, developers are charged with controlling stormwater, but with urban runoff making up 13, 18, and 32% of pollution in rivers, lakes, and estuaries respectively, the National Academy of Sciences says it's time for better federal regulation. And though the problem of urban runoff has been known for decades, it may be another 5 to 10 years before the regulatory framework can be built to properly control it. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll speak with another online innovator, Jennifer Coleman of CityProwl.com. You're listening to Smart City.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out. Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jennifer Coleman has 20 years' experience as an architect dedicated to improving city life through smart design. But her latest project appeals as much to the ears as to the eyes. She's created CityProwl.com. City Prowls are downloadable walking tours of famous landmarks and famous neighborhoods in her home city of Cleveland. Jennifer, tell me about City Prowl.
City Prowl is actually a company that produces audio walking tours of cities that you can download from a website and take at the listener's own convenience. So they're about between a half an hour and 45 minutes. So it's something that someone can do over a lunchtime. But we try to get into the things that make cities special, whether it's architectural or cultural, what's happening in the city, some of the wonderful histories. I had started the company about 2 years ago, really because I'm an architect and have been in the Cleveland area for about 20 years. And I felt that there were so many great stories after doing especially a lot of renovation projects. There's just wonderful stories that start off with the buildings, or actually maybe sometimes they end with the buildings, but the story of how they came to be, I thought, were so fascinating. And that if people really understood these stories, they'd kind of realize just how special the city is. So that's how City Prowl began.
Is it typical for people to want to take audio tours of places? What's the model for you?
The model actually is quite new. The idea really occurred to me and started to take wing after I discovered podcasting in probably around 2005, 2006. I just thought that technology just lifted so many barriers. You know, when you think of doing tours before, you think of sort of making an appointment somewhere and hoping for good weather and going out and seeing the city as part of a group. Especially being in a city close to the Great Lakes, good weather is not always a given. So it's always sort of sometimes a dicey proposition. So when podcasting came about, it really freed up, you know, we're all extremely busy people these days. And you really have to kind of coincide things to your schedules or your family schedules. And I thought, well, gee, with a podcast, you could do this. If you want to get out early on a Saturday morning and take a quick tour, you can do it. So the technology, I think, really kind of caught on with the idea of people really scheduling and looking for something that's interesting to them, but something that's extremely accessible for them to do.
Now, you produced your first City Prowl around Cleveland, where you live now. Describe your favorite Cleveland Prowl.
That's sort of like asking what's your favorite child, but you know, I think that the most amazing one to me was the Cleveland Arcades. And that's for kind of a long-standing reasons. When I was in school, the one thing that was when I told folks I was from Cleveland, you have the Cleveland Arcade. Like the arcade. Why would people kind of know about the arcade? It was sort of a place downtown and didn't get a lot of hoopla. And I very quickly discovered that it's one of the premier arcades in the world. For reasons because of the size of it, the scope, the absolutely breathtaking beauty of it. And this is something that I really don't think Clevelanders view their arcade as something special. But I think the fact that it was so well known throughout the world was something that I really wanted to communicate.
Wow, you've made me reach back into my own memory. I remember years ago there was a fabulous piece done on plans for Cleveland and Cleveland's downtown. I can't remember who did it, but this was literally years ago, and it's probably still boxed up in my basement in Memphis somewhere. but it featured the arcade, and I remember falling instantly in love with it. What does the Prowl tell you about the arcade that you couldn't have learned from a sign or a brochure?
It really talks about some of the history, some of the interesting tenets of the arcade. It's had a very kind of storied history in the world, or really in town, with a lot of very interesting tenants. We've had some absolutely fascinating bookstores. I think there was a bookstore that was actually raided in the 1960s because it had some provocative materials in it.
My, how times have changed.
Yeah, we'll just kind of leave that story as it is. But, you know, I actually interviewed someone who worked in another bookstore in the arcade who's actually in New York City now. And he just talked about how it was to work in the arcade in the 70s. Now in its latest iteration and renaissance, good chunk of it is a hotel. So that was a renovation that was done in the last, about a little bit over 5 years ago. And it's been restored beautifully. Luckily, it was a building that did not have a lot of renovations in the last, 125 years. So it was easy to restore, I think, to its astonishing beauty.
Now, each tour has a fellow. Describe that role.
This is something that has come about recently that I've actually took in institutionalized, and I'm beside myself with happiness. After the first Prowl that I did was released, I got a little bit of press, and I had some high school student, a young woman from a high school close by, who's, I think she's in college now, but she called and said, is there anything that I can do to help? I think the idea is a really nice one. And I thought, well, this is great. Why don't you come down and we can talk about maybe doing some research? And in that case, it was for the arcades tour. So we met, we sat down, and I gave her some of the books that I had been using for research and told her to hit the libraries and gave her some of the topics that I was interested in, and she came back with a wonderful, wonderful series of research that I used for the basis of the arcade tour. So the next summer of 2007, had another kid call me up. Same thing. So I gave her, I wanted her to research some banking history, which is actually pretty intense even for a high school student. But it was about the Cleveland bank lobbies, which are another hidden gem. It's not something you'd sort of get out in the morning and say, hey, let me look at Cleveland's bank lobbies. But there's a lot of breathtaking, beautiful lobbies in the city. So not only did she enjoy herself, but even her mom sent me an email saying how much she thought that Adrian had gotten over the summer doing this project. So I thought, well, especially as I'm starting to expand, it would be wonderful to actually include that, so that I instituted something called a City Prowl Fellow. So as I work on a series of tours, I want to have a high school student who is interested in cities and, has a sort of a burgeoning civic passion, if you will, and have them do research and learn wonderful things about the cities that they live in. I think it's going to be fun. And I'm working with a local high school on coming up with a volunteer service plan so that it really has teeth and the student can get as much as they can out of it.
Wow. I love that idea. When I was in high school, my hometown of Memphis celebrated its sesquicentennial. And I got completely wrapped up in the history of the city and had fallen in love with it really before that, but that solidified it and have been in love ever since. I think it's wonderful when young people can get to know their city and its history in that sort of way and have it turn into something that's so contemporary and productive. You said that each tour, Jennifer, is about a half hour to an hour. Is there a fee?
For downloading, actually, in the Cleveland area, because Cleveland is sort of my oyster or my laboratory, I have not. I actually have been working through sponsorships with different companies, because I guess we haven't talked a little bit about the fact that I am going to be expanding to other cities. And I'm sort of reviewing my options, especially as I try to form partnerships with some nonprofits. It might be a revenue generator, not only for me, but for my partner. My local partner in the different cities.
Have you only completed tours for the city of Cleveland to date?
Yes, I have done 5 tours, which is probably a little over 3 hours worth of tours in the city. Actually, right now I'm working on some neighborhoods, some of the historic neighborhoods in Cleveland. So I'll be working on those this fall, but I'm also starting to reach out to about 5 cities nationally. that I think would just be awesome. Actually, I would love to do as many cities as there are. But right now, it's been really kind of fun categorizing and seeing which cities I think right now would be ripe for this. One thing, especially when I mentioned to my friends what's happening, they are always saying, oh, you should do Paris and you should do New York and sort of all these big cities. And I realized I really wanted to focus in on mid-sized cities. First of all, because number one, who are doing audio walking tours, it's a big tourist market. My market is a little different because I am working through a passion for cities, not a passion for getting tourism into the city, although that can work into it also. But a lot of the tourist cities, like the Londons and New Yorks, have this concept already in place. And like I said, it's geared a little bit more towards tourism. But mid-sized cities really, number one, they've got equally as fantastic stories as the big cities. But those stories are kind of likely to get lost. And my ideal, my perfect listener is the person who's been a lifelong or has lived in the city for a while who listens to this and says, gee, I really didn't know about this. My favorite, I think I have a quote on my website that's from someone who said, hey, I haven't been downtown in 20 years. And taking this tour, I went down and had a great time today. And really, that is, in a nutshell, the reason is behind City Prowl, is to get people out and enjoy their city and be ambassadors for their city.
Jennifer, I appreciate you talking with us today on Smart City. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Coleman is the CEO of City Prowls. During our interview, she mentioned the tour that features Cleveland's beautiful and historic arcade. If you've never been to Cleveland, or if you haven't quite made it to the arcade, here's an excerpt from that walking tour.
Hello, and welcome to the Arcades edition of City Prowl Cleveland. I am sitting right now in a comfy leather couch located on the lower level of the old arcade, close to the Superior Avenue entrance. Come join me on the couch if you can, as we soak up the ambience of this extraordinary space. Take a look around you at this beloved Cleveland landmark, built over 115 years ago, as a result of Cleveland's building and financial boom during the Industrial Revolution. But did you know that you cannot find a comparable arcade of this style or size in the United States, and just a few others rival it in the entire world? I sure didn't until I attended college and found my architectural professors consider the old arcade as an iconic structure that occupies a pivotal role in the history of world architecture. I found many references to the building in my studies, and couldn't help but feel pride that the old arcade was located in my hometown, but also a little chagrin that I had to leave Cleveland to realize just how special it was. The purpose of the arcade building type was to be a glass-covered passageway that connects two busy streets and is lined on both sides with shops. The first arcades were built in Paris at the beginning of the 19th century. They were developed as a device to meet specific needs of a society in a period of cultural and industrial growth. In short, the city needed a pleasant area, protected from traffic and weather, to display and sell the new luxury items that were flooding the market. All right, let's get set for today's prowl. First, let's stand up, and we're going to start walking towards the main stair next to the food court. As we walk, I'll bring you up to speed on how the building type developed in the arcades 150 years ago. Remember to follow my pace. The first arcades, six of them all built in Europe, were built between 1800 and 1820 and were constructed of wood and very narrow, the promenade being only 10 feet wide, with stores on either side. There were no great skylit roofs then. Light was brought in through windows above the shops. By 1840, metal and glass roof construction had been developed, and the building type made its way to America, first in Philadelphia and then Providence, Rhode Island. They were regarded not just as connective space between buildings, but as standalone destinations that helped define the city and draw people to its center. The last 20 years of the 19th century saw the size of arcades grow to gigantic proportions, and our old arcade is the epitome of this period.
It soars to 5 stories and is enclosed on both sides by early high-rise buildings designed with cutting-edge skyscraper engineering. We're approaching the stairs leading up to the Euclid Avenue level. Go up the stairs and turn right. We will then promenade the floor in a clockwise direction. As you look around the arcade, you must agree that every view is a feast for the eyes. Coffered soffits, gilded and ornamented borders above the storefront, no surface was left plain. Look at the grand staircase that we're standing on. It was said that years ago, the circular glass set in the stair risers used to actually glow with a red cast from the heat of the nearby boiler room. As we get to the top of the stairs, remember to turn right and head over to one of the 2-seat tables overlooking the floor below and take a seat. If none are available, just stand by the railing for a moment. So, the question is, how did a world-class structure end up in our fair city? Let's look at Cleveland in the middle of the 19th century. In 1860, Cleveland was only a small commercial city with just over 43,000 inhabitants. Local railroad lines strategically linked Cleveland to New York City, and these transportation routes gave Cleveland easy access to the nation's markets, which provided a strong foundation for economic development. The Civil War further jump-started Cleveland's economy by creating the demand for materials and supplies. Cleveland soon became an important transshipment point, and the raw materials that flowed through the city fueled the new iron and steel industries. By 1870, there were over 1,100 manufacturing businesses in Cuyahoga County alone. During this time, Cleveland's population also boomed. Between 1860 and 1870, the population more than doubled, with immigrants and transplanted New Englanders who came searching for the economic opportunities of an industrial city. Many of those who arrived were capitalists eager to invest in the new industries of oil, iron, and steel, and made Cleveland the base of their economic enterprises. These tycoons bought with them money, innovation, and power. Soon, Cleveland was the 15th largest city in the nation, and by the late 19th century was considered a national industrial center. The wealth and prestige that Cleveland had accumulated led to a building boom at the end of the century that included the old arcade. The arcade became a hub of city life. The citizens of Cleveland took their Sunday strolls around the arcade and listened to the lunchtime concerts given by visiting orchestras. 5 years after its opening, the National Convention of Republican Clubs had events on the floor of the arcade, where 2,000 delegates attended. Through the years, many Cleveland business stalwarts and institutions were tenants in the arcade, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Cleveland School of Music, and the Builders Exchange. Stouffer's Restaurant started their restaurant empire in the arcade with a sandwich shop in 1922.
I had a bookstore at the foot of the Euclid Avenue stairs. In the back, there was a high-class, New York-caliber art gallery. I mean, he had Warhols, he had Rauschenbergs, he had the whole bit of that era. The classic E.O. bookshop. I'm telling you, people from all over the country would stop in and say, wow, they'd never seen a bookstore like this. So the contrast was unique. It was fantastic. It was like a little town. The light and the mood of it changed depending on the sky. I mean, if the sun was out, the sun came through those skylights. At night, it would get, yeah, obviously, dusk would come, and they'd turn on the interior lights along the railings. Yeah, it was spectacular.
Bill Gunlock, former tenant of the arcade during the 1970s. As Cleveland's downtown declined in the later part of the 20th century, the old arcade became a hidden jewel in the city as the population and visitors filtered out to the suburbs. But in 1973, the arcade became Cleveland's first building to be added to the National Historic Register, and only the 9th in the nation. In 2001, the arcade underwent a $60 million renovation when the Hyatt Regency Hotel became the arcade's major tenant. All of the beautiful balustrade detailing, gilded storefronts, and intricate carvings were restored to their original glory. John Hawkins of the Hyatt Regency Hotel.
The renovations are pretty specific. Actually, it's so beautiful, it reminds me of the past arcade, less the many businesses. It's just a great place to be. It's just quiet and peaceful. It gives you a chance to reflect or just to enjoy a quiet moment. We say we need our quiet moments in the day. This would be a place that would bring many quiet moments to many troubled souls.
Today, the Old Arcade is as majestic and civically relevant as it was when it opened over 115 years ago. The hotel fits seamlessly into the space, delivering unique views into the arcade to its guests. While the upper floors are accessible only to the visitors, the two public floors have a lively variety of tenants that value having such a historical address. Susan Barrett, owner of Cleveland and Beyond.
Our favorite thing about the arcade is the beauty of the building, the history of the building, and the way those two really come together in modern day. Today, the building's as beautiful as it was then, and we have a unique blend of customers. A lot of them are hesitant as to walking into the building because they're not sure of what they're going to find. But once they do walk in the building, it instantly becomes one of their favorites, and they ask question after question after question about the building.
As we enter the Euclid Avenue lobby, you can see more examples of the arcade's lavish ornamentalism. See if you can find the caduceus, a double serpent intertwined with a winged staff. The caduceus became a symbol for the medical profession at the beginning of the 20th century, but it originated as a magic staff of the Greek god Hermes, who is a god of commerce, eloquence, travel, and invention. What an appropriate symbol for the arcade. You can find it over some of the storefronts also. We're going to head out of the lobby and leave the arcade now. When we get to the doors, walk up Euclid Avenue to the two smaller arcades, the Euclid and the Colonial. We'll be turning left when we get outside.
Want to hear more City Prowls? There's a link to Jennifer's site on our site, smartcityradio.com. The world can be a scary place. Sometimes it seems like the end of the world as we know it, but Walker Smith feels fine. This week's City Views commentator takes some of the air out of the bubble of nostalgia.
In college, I used to wake up in a sweat from nightmares of nuclear annihilation. These were pretty vivid dreams about post-apocalyptic survival in a world denuded by nuclear war. To this day, I can remember these bad dreams quite clearly. Fortunately, I haven't had these nightmares since I left school, so maybe they were nothing but channeled anxiety about my coursework. But surely my course load wasn't that extreme. Besides, I had other dreams more directly connected to the test I was always underprepared for. These dreams were more in keeping with the temper of those times and the collective anxieties of that era. After all, I grew up just after the bomb shelter craze and the duck and cover drills in school. The Cuban Missile Crisis was still fairly recent news, and once a month or so, civil defense would test the town's siren while the local TV station would test its emergency broadcast system. The U.S. and the USSR were always involved in aggressive posturing during my adolescent and teenage years. The doomsday clock of the Union of Concerned Scientists was constantly in the news. Nowadays, we hear a lot about the good old days when kids could ride their bikes all over town without worry and people could leave their doors unlocked. Moms were stay-at-home and dads ran the household. It was all cowboys and Indians, Barbie and Ken, and the wide world of color. Well, maybe. But whatever it was, I didn't get much restful sleep back then. In fact, I remember lots of worrisome things, like polio and thalidomide, like the fear of war and its reality in places like Korea, Vietnam, and Cambodia, like gas lines around the block, stagflation, and cities rioting and aflame. Civil rights and women's rights were yet to be secured. Heck, even small luxuries like air conditioning weren't widespread. The first house I ever lived in with central air was one I bought myself at age 35. Sure, gas prices are high today, but not as high in relative terms as they were in 1980. Interest rates for mortgages are trending above 6, but I remember when they were double-digit. We hear a lot about crimes against children these days, but these crimes are actually down, way down, all across the board. And a list like this could go on and on. The fact of the matter is that nostalgia for the past is a misbegotten daydream. The past was not better than today. Indeed, in almost every instance, it was worse. We cheat our future and that of our children when we try to recreate some facsimile version of a past that never actually existed. The best way forward is not to circle back, but to forge ahead. And especially for me, I've come to like not waking up from nightmares of nuclear annihilation. Who wants to go back to that? Sure, we've got problems today, but no past is going to fix what needs solving now. The only way we will get to a better place is to create it for ourselves for tomorrow, not by wallowing in a past we only seem to remember through rose-colored glasses. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and he joins us every week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book, and a good one at that, is Generation Ageless. Want to try out some of the websites you heard about on today's show? Well, go over to Smart City Radio for the links to our guest work. While you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list, listen to archive shows, or subscribe to our podcast. If you have a question about something you heard on the show, click on the contact link or send an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty, the cake is a lie, Isari, is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.